keep your distance in case they attack you.
Alan, do not get attacked by a swan. We had someone attacked by a bull this week. Alan, you are the MMP for Christchurch. We'll send you a certificate and a rosette. Thank you for your message today. Thank you for listening. A slightly crazy show. Stay tuned. Drive next with Tony and Holly. I'll see you Monday. Have a good weekend.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
A very good afternoon. At 4 o'clock, here are your BBC News headlines. And the Prime Minister has paid tribute to Dame Maggie Smith, who has died aged 89, describing her as a true national treasure. In a career spanning almost 70 years, the actress won two Oscars in 1969 and 1978. She went on to win a new generation of fans as Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films and in Downton Abbey. Our entertainment correspondent is Colin Patterson.
When you think about her career, so much of her biggest success came so late on, because at the same time she was doing Harry Potter, there was also Downton Abbey with the Countess of Grantham. Just the way that she had those withering put-downs throughout that series, providing the laughs, the menace, and just that, the authority as the head of that household there.
A statement from Dame Maggie's sons, the actors Toby Stevens and Chris Larkin, described her as an extraordinary mother and grandmother. Two boys have been given life sentences with a minimum of 8.5 years for murdering a man with a machete. The pair, who can't be named, were just 12 years old when they attacked 19-year-old Sean Sisay-Hay in a park in Wolverhampton last November. The judge, Mrs. Justice Tipple, spoke about the victim's character during sentencing.
Sean Sisay-Hay had a unique personality, was a humble person who loved to help others and cared deeply about his family. His mother has described him as a brave soul who was generous and compassionate.
Elsewhere, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has praised what he's described as the incredible courage of Israeli soldiers while addressing world leaders at the UN General Assembly. Despite pressure on him to agree to a ceasefire with Hezbollah in Lebanon, Mr. Netanyahu said that Israel's offensive there would continue until his country succeeded in its objectives. Donald Trump is meeting the Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky in New York. The Republican presidential candidate says he'll work with both Ukraine and Russia to end their conflict. Mr. Trump has repeatedly criticised Mr. Zelensky while on the campaign trail. A major review of the way police forces in England and Wales deal with reports of stalking has called for significant changes to better protect victims. The report said safeguarding failures were leaving some victims at serious risk. And two Just Stop Oil activists have been jailed for throwing soup over Vincent van Gogh's Sunflowers painting at London's National Gallery. 23-year-old Phoebe Plummer was sentenced to 2 years, while 22-year-old Anna Holland received a 20-month term. And with cricket and all of the sport today, Mike McCarthy's here.
And we'll start with this. The last few moments, the All England club's been granted planning permission to build 39 new tennis courts on Wimbledon Park. It's after the Deputy London Mayor Jules Pipe decided significant community and economic benefits outweigh the harm to protected open land. Local residents and politicians fighting the plans could still apply for a judicial review. England's one-day international series with Australia is on the line, with England needing to win the fourth ODI to keep the series alive. Ellie Aldroyd has the latest on a rain-affected match at Lord's.
Yes, rain has reduced it to 39 overs aside. England 92 for 2 after 16 overs, with Ben Duckett still there on 37, Harry Brook on 16. Two wickets to go, Phil Salt out for 22 and Will Jacks out for 10. Bit of cloud overhead at Lord's, but we're hoping that we won't get any more interruptions. 92 for 2 England after 16.
Uninterrupted commentary on Five Sports Extra, and Manchester City boss Pep Guardiola says they'll wait before deciding whether to find cover for Rodri during the January transfer window. The Spanish midfielder has been ruled out for the rest of the season following knee surgery.
In the latest travel news, on the roads in Cheshire, the M56 eastbound one lane is closed near Junction 14 at Chester Services. There's been an accident there. You've got some queuing traffic on the approach. The West Midlands, the M5 northbound, there was an obstruction on the road earlier before the M6 interchange. All restrictions there have been lifted, but you've got congestion to the Albury turnoff at Junction 2. The M25 clockwise, there was an accident earlier before Junction 30 at Lakeside. All lanes back open now, but still congestion to Romford at 29. In Kent, the M26 M6 eastbound. That's partially blocked because of an accident from Junction 2 to Junction 3, the M20. You've got delays because of that. In terms of flooding, we have had some problems today because of all the water around. Major routes on the roads seem clear for now. You've still got some issues on local routes, so worth double check if you're in an affected area. And on the trains, still some problems through Wiltshire and Shropshire. So again, it's wise to double check before you set off today. There might be delays or cancellations. Ellie Brennan, 5 Live Travel.
Cheers, Ellie. Thanks very much indeed. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Friday's Drive. Holly Hamilton's with me. Hello, Holly.
Hello, a very good afternoon to
you. Suitcase packed and next to your desk. You cannot wait to get out of here.
Yeah, it does look like that, doesn't it? It's not the case, I promise.
Surprised you've not checked in while we've been preparing for the show.
That's actually just all the stuff I bring with me every day. An entire suitcase with the kitchen sink.
It's well been prepared. Lovely in your company this week.
I've really enjoyed it. Oh, I really have. And the listeners have been brilliant.
They've been very nice. Yeah, they like you a lot. Now
they'll correct you now.
I won't give the number. I will give them. They know. Look, we've got all the news of the day, as you would imagine. Today we'll touch on the Middle East, we'll touch on politics. However, hard to look past the sad news that we've had this afternoon, the death of Dame Maggie Smith, an absolute legend, national treasure. The Prime Minister's referred to her as such. I think we all think the same as well. 89. And when you look at her CV, Holly, the things she's done, the things she's achieved, the things she's been in. It's incredible.
It's so vast, isn't it? She's one of these people that you just, and we were doing it in the office a little earlier on, where you're sitting there going, oh, do you remember when she was in this? Do you remember her in that? Do you remember? Of course, you know, we talk about Harry Potter and Downton Abbey. The one that came to me was The Secret Garden. That was probably the first film I ever saw her in. I was a little bit scared of her. That was the power that she had. She was just amazing.
Somebody texted her. I don't know if Matt read this out because he's had a lot going on his show earlier on, but there's a text that came into Matt's show just saying that she ought to be celebrated. She's one of... here it is. I'll read it out, actually. Forgive me if Matt already read this out. Richard in Stockport said, Maggie Smith's passing is truly significant. One of the last actresses of who it could be truly said that she's as brilliant on stage as she was on screen. I hope she'll receive the acclaim she deserves for being a true great who was able to cross different media with ease. Rest in peace. That's from Richard in Stockport. So, look, if you've got any memories of Maggie Smith, you came across her, you just want to celebrate some of the things you saw, and that she won an Oscar for The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. You must watch that this weekend if you get a chance. So we're going to talk a lot about that. Pauline Black's going to join us as well, another music legend. We have P.P. Arnold on the show. Yes, Pauline Black will be with us talking about a new film about Two Tone. But Pauline's story herself, she was in the Selector. Her story's amazing. She'll tell us that a little bit later on.
Yeah, we'll obviously bring you all the latest from the cricket as well, from the fourth ODI against Australia. And speaking of legends, we've got Hamza Yassin on the show today. He is a firm favourite in our house. I've got a three-year-old. And he is obsessed, absolutely obsessed. He's brilliant. You might know him from Strictly, of course, as well as his wildlife programmes on CBeebies. He's got a new book out. It's brilliant. Expect some animal noises.
Yeah, it does. There's a fundamental problem with that interview I've done with Hamza, which I will get to when we play it later on. So that's coming up on the show. Fact of the Day is here as well, and it promises to be a unique version of Fact of the Day, although Alistair Bruce Ball doesn't know it yet till he's on. Anyway, more of that anon. It's 7 minutes past four.
Football on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Listen to exclusive live commentaries from the Premier League, Champions League and more with the 5 Live Sport team.
He's been on the pitch for 10 seconds. Thank you very much.
Stay on top of everything football every day with the Football Daily Podcast.
This is the best central defensive partnership in European football.
His confidence levels are through the roof.
Football on 5 Live.
Listen on BBC Sound.
The voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Thanks for being with us this afternoon. Two boys who were just 12 when they killed a man with a machete have become Britain's youngest ever knife murderers. They're now 13 and have each been sentenced to a minimum of 8.5 years in prison. They stabbed 19-year-old Sean Cesarhigh in a park in Wolverhampton last November. Here's the judge, Mrs. Justice Tipples.
Sean Cesarhigh had a unique personality. Was a humble person who loved to help others and cared deeply about his family. His mother has described him as a brave soul who was generous and compassionate.
Well, Chief Superintendent Kim Maddle from West Midlands Police spoke just outside the court today.
The impact of knife crime is devastating, no matter where you live in the country. This is an issue that affects us all. Much work has been done and we have had successes in some areas. However, this is clearly not enough.
Well, let's speak now to our correspondent, Navtej Johal. Oh, good afternoon. I mean, it's been a pretty shocking case throughout all of this. Just remind us what happened and what was said in court today.
That's right, Holly. This case has indeed been disturbing. It's been shocking. I think maybe the two or three things which immediately come to mind as to why this has been such a disturbing case to follow is, A, of course, the age of the boys. 12 years old at the time of the killing, 13 now. B, it's the reason why this happened, essentially for no reason at all. It was described in court as being a senseless murder over a trivial matter. And then finally as well, this is not an incident where we've seen the boys accept responsibility during the course of the trial. They blamed each other. And the devastation that this has caused Sean Cesar-High's family is clear for all to see. And this was the day when the legal process in this case came to an end. It followed the trial in June, and the sentencing has lasted 2 days. The judge, Mrs. Justice Tipples, read out the sentences to the boys, who are now both, as I say, 13 years old. She laid out why they were receiving the sentences they were, a minimum term of 8.5 years for each boy. And she talked about their lives, one of them in particular. She said this boy, who she referred to as the first defendant, had been groomed and exploited. He'd been known to children's services from a very young age and had been a victim of modern slavery and criminal exploitation. She also said that the view of the professionals who had assessed him was that all of this had contributed indirectly towards his participation in Sean's murder. The other boy was not known to police or social services. But you also heard there Justice Tipples, the judge, giving a tribute to Sean Cesar-High and to his family, who have been incredibly dignified throughout this process and were watching proceedings via a video link.
Yeah, it is, as you say, such a complex case. You know, we heard about the lives of these boys, and obviously that has played a role in terms of their sentencing and when they're eligible for parole. How did the boys react in court today to the sentencing?
There wasn't a great deal of reaction. It's been a strange case in terms of the setup of the court. Normally, in a criminal court trial like this one, you would expect for the defendants to be in the dock, for the judge and the barristers to be wearing robes and wigs. None of that happened. There were no robes, there were no wigs. The defendant sat in the main area of the court, the well of the court, rather than in the dock. They each had a family member sat next to them and a court-appointed, specially trained member of staff explaining the proceedings, supporting the defendants as well. Now, they will serve at least 8.5 years in a secure unit, and Children UK are not sent to adult prisons. They will go back to the same accommodation where they've been held since they were arrested for the killing last year. They will then be eligible for parole when they're 20 years old. And if they're released, they will then be on licence for the rest of their lives, which means they will have to follow strict rules around their movements and behaviours.
Interesting how the judge spoke afterwards, saying that the family of the victim will not be comforted by this sentence. How has the family responded?
Yes, that's right. The family of Sean Cesar-High, who are originally from Anguilla in the Caribbean, that's where they live, they couldn't afford to come over to the UK for the sentencing. In fact, they say they had to use their life savings and take out a loan to have their son's body repatriated and to attend the trial in June. And in a statement after the sentence was read out, they've said that they are disappointed in the sentence. They say they do not feel that the sentence reflects the loss they have suffered. And they go on to describe knife crime as a social crisis. And yesterday, in a victim impact statement, they said they were devastated, totally heartbroken and confused, because to them, it appeared that their son had been killed for no reason at all.
Navtej Jahal, thanks for your insight in that. So there's further reaction to that on the BBC News webpages as well.
So knife crime front and centre again, youth crime front and centre. Dr Naomi Murphy is a consultant clinical forensic psychologist. Joins us now. Naomi, hello.
Hi.
Really scary stuff for people listening into this. And I guess a very generalised question will be from, certainly though, well, I was going to say those in the older end, but not, because children have to navigate this kind of threat as well. How has it come to this, that knives are far more prevalent than they used to be? And a slight, which could have been laughed off in a playground, is suddenly a reason for murder.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it is a heinous act, and I think it's natural for us to seek explanations. I think sadly, in some ways, Sean Caesar-High was probably just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, and a dispute arises over a bench, which was probably just a pretext the boys needed, you know, in order to be aggressive. It's not normal for children to use this kind of violence, and these are the youngest children in Britain to have committed murder in 30 years. So I think, you know, it's important to keep a sense of proportionality about it. But obviously we are seeing more and more children carrying knives, and children do that partly because they don't feel safe and partly because there is an emphasis in some parts of youth culture to try and look tougher. You know, I've spent nearly three decades working with people who've killed. They've always had histories of abuse and neglect during childhood. And when you've experienced violence and abuse, it's really, you don't learn how to manage your feelings. And some people end up carrying around quite a lot of rage. So if you're powerless to direct it at the people who've hurt you, this can end up being displaced onto someone who just happens to be innocently irritating you in another way.
Yeah, it's a societal problem. There'll be those definitely who's saying, well, you know, their families should have done better. But sometimes families can't cope or yes, you know, or the children are very difficult to handle. So where are we on earlier intervention? Because there are some people who then say, oh, it's the nanny state, you're getting involved in families, but some families just are, you know, are not able to function as we would, as you would class normally.
Well, you're absolutely right. And also, you know, we know that poverty has an impact on violence within the family home. And obviously we're seeing increasing levels of poverty, people having to go to food banks. So when families are under stress and pressure, they're more likely to not be able to cope within the family home. People are more likely to turn to substances or violence, which might be facilitated by the use of drink, for instance. So in some ways, poverty probably plays some role. And also we've seen, you know, the reduction, you know, youth services have been absolutely decimated during austerity. So, you know, people who've managed to extricate themselves from a pathway that looked to be headed towards crime highlight the importance of having, you know, being mentored, having a connection with somebody who believes in them and offers them hope. Well, when youth services are taken away, this removes an important source of hope for young people, and it leaves young boys in particular particularly vulnerable to the, you know, being groomed by older youths and young men who try and incorporate them into the life of crime because they know that typically they'll get shorter sentences.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully the least that will happen is there'll be a lot of conversations happening around tea tables tonight with any parents with young children about the people that they're mixing with and the situations they're finding themselves. Just to end, Naomi, because time's against us, let's look at the other end of the process, the criminal justice system, because these boys will be out in their 20s, you would imagine. I mean, rehabilitation's at the heart of the system in this country, isn't it? But while there is horror at what they've done, there is also, I don't, you know, and you can probably understand this, a bit of horror and shock at the length of the sentences, because they've the 8.5 years they will be out in their 20s. This text here says, I'm not a lock 'em up type, especially with children, but 8.5 years isn't long enough to rehabilitate, especially when the murder is seen as senseless as this. It's no justice for the victim's parents and no real deterrent nor therapy support. What do you make of those arguments?
Well, I'd argue that prison isn't a deterrent, actually, because most violent crime is committed when people are in a state of emotional arousal. Everyone knows murder is wrong, but murders happen. I think it's really natural to want to see an eye for an eye to some degree, you know, to see the loss of if not life, but the loss of freedom to live life. But you have to remember also that we have the lowest age of criminal responsibility in Europe. So in most of the European countries, these boys would not be considered old enough or competent enough to carry responsibility for their actions. And, you know, actually 8 years is more than half the time that they've been alive already. That, you know, at least one of these boys is clearly traumatised. I would suggest the other one probably has some degree of trauma, given he spent time living in a refuge, which would suggest exposure to domestic violence. And actually being in an institution will allow them some opportunity for engagement in in work to help them heal, but actually to grow up entirely. You know, our brains are quite plastic. So actually, do we want to spend £65,000 or more a year keeping them in prison for the rest of their lives? Or would it not be better to try and help them heal and return to society and play a role? And people do get out of prison and contribute something useful after, you know, serving life sentences for horrible crimes.
Indeed. Naomi, thank you for that. I'm sure anyone listening today will have a thought about that. Thank you, Dr. Naomi Murphy, their consultant clinical forensic psychologist. If you want to respond to what you've heard, 85058, or you know the WhatsApp number, 08085 909 693.
Yeah, we're going to be coming back to that story just after 6 o'clock this evening. We'll be finding out, you know, what life behind bars is like for a child as young as 12, and what happens next in terms of rehabilitation. As I say, all that coming up after 6 o'clock, and then after 8:30, we'll be hearing tributes to Dame Maggie Smith, of course, whose death was announced today. 85058 if you've got any reaction to that at all.
Yeah, acknowledged by the Prime Minister himself today, actually, as a national treasure. And we've also got another national treasure on the show today for the younger generation, certainly the wildlife photographer and Strictly winner Hamza Yassin, who's got a new book out. It's great as well. So he's going to join us on the show. And we're nearly in October, but we do have cricket, albeit delayed by the rain. It's a one-day international, England against Australia at Lords. The Aussies lead the five-match series 2-1. That's all the background to give us the current news is Ellie Oldroyd. Ellie, hello.
It's the penultimate game of the season as well in this country, because there's a game at Bristol on Sunday as well. But England 112 for 2 currently. It's not been the easiest time batting out there. We've only seen 1-6 scored, and that was by Ben Duckett, who is on 53. So second time he's passed 50 in this series. Harry Brook is on 21. Brook actually given out, caught down the leg side, and then when the umpires looked again, it showed that it had actually hit the ground before it was picked up behind the stumps by Josh Inglis. And hearty boos around the ground for an Australian wicketkeeper, a bit like the Ashes last season. But England not going too badly, 113 for 2 in the 19th over. It's 39 overs aside this because of the rain.
Good stuff, Ellie. Plenty of time to chat in the programme. Speak to you later. 21 past 4 now.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We need somebody to look after our economy.
It's the biggest issue in Scotland at the moment.
Wherever you are in the UK, you're part of this with us on this network. 5 Live Drive.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now, over at the United Nations in New York, we've been hearing from the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who's been saying his country is winning the war against Hezbollah and Hamas.
I decided to come here to speak for my people, to speak for my country, to speak for the truth. And here's the truth. Israel seeks peace. Israel yearns for peace. Israel has made peace and will make peace again. Yet we face savage enemies who seek our annihilation, and we must defend ourselves against these savage murderers.
Now, his speech, of course, comes at a time as the Israeli military continue their offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon, despite international calls for a ceasefire. Some people actually booed, others walked out as Mr. Netanyahu spoke, others did cheer. He took aim at Hamas and Hezbollah as well as Iran. Now, Israel is also under international pressure, along with Hamas, to agree to a ceasefire and the release of hostages in Gaza. Prince Khalid bin Bandar al-Saud, Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the UK, has been speaking on Radio 4 today.
The simple solution is a Palestinian state and a solution to the Palestinian cause. Now, executing that is difficult. There's no question. It's not easy. But if they don't address the core problem, there will always be a problem. If we hit a direction towards a Palestinian state and we can bring, I don't know about this Israeli government, but an Israeli government to the table that commits to that, that changes the whole dynamic of what's happening on the ground.
Well, speaking of on the ground, Israel has also been carrying out more strikes in southern Lebanon, with the Lebanese health minister saying 25 people have been killed. Our correspondent, Daniel De Simone, is in Jerusalem. Daniel, I'm sure you were listening to that speech, and we know that Benjamin Netanyahu is an extremely good orator. He came out swinging almost. He said that this was his intention to put the record straight. What did you make of it?
Well, I think there was some speculation that he may at least open the door to a possible diplomatic route to a ceasefire with Hezbollah, given all of the talk about that this week, or that he may even still hold that route open in relation to Hamas in Gaza. But in his speech today, he made absolutely no reference to the possibility of a ceasefire. He said that his government will keep on fighting Hezbollah until victory, until their goals are achieved, which is the goal in the north of Israel relates to returning home 60,000 Israelis who've been displaced by Hezbollah rocket fire. That goal's not been met because Hezbollah's still firing rockets. And in relation to Gaza, he effectively said that Hamas is almost defeated, is, I think, a fair characterization of what he said, and that the way for this to end is for Hamas to surrender, really, and hand over hostages, which I think strongly suggests he doesn't see a ceasefire deal with Hamas as something he is considering. So I think a lot of people who want to see a ceasefire in Gaza and in Hezbollah will be a bit dismayed by what he said. And I think it's important to add that, you know, a lot of people see the way to a ceasefire in with Hezbollah in the north as the only way to get that is in relation to Gaza. Hezbollah itself, whether one believes it or not, has said it would have a ceasefire only when there's a ceasefire in Gaza. So I think this was a real defence by Benjamin Netanyahu of his government's record over the past year and its current actions in Lebanon.
Yeah, because it's interesting because we're sort of cyclical here in the sense that what he wants, well, it's unlikely at this point that Hezbollah or Hamas will agree to that. So while Netanyahu is focusing on this idea of total victory and these kind of maximalist objectives, he's still not giving any real details as to what exactly that looks like.
Well, an example is that he's been criticised from within his own cabinet in the past for apparent lack of planning for Gaza after this war ends, whenever that is. And I think the speech today did little to dispel such criticisms. He made brief reference to being ready to support a civilian administration in Gaza eventually. But other than that, there was few details beyond saying Hamas can have no role and that Gaza must be demilitarised and de-radicalised. I think in terms of Lebanon, he is just simply restating the position that his government has been saying publicly for certainly the last couple of weeks, which is they see a military way through this. They see a military way to achieving their objectives. And despite yesterday, there was a lot of talk about the US proposal for a 21-day ceasefire. When that was first became public yesterday morning, Mr. Netanyahu's office released a statement which gave the impression that this was sort of news to him and that he hadn't responded yet to it and that he was going to carry on instructing his military to fight. It then became apparent overnight that I think there had been an awareness within the Israeli government about this proposal. There had been an engagement with it. And I think the Americans and others were quite disappointed because they felt that had been there had been a genuine engagement with that. So at the moment, publicly at least, he's not considering a diplomatic way out of this. There may be a difference in private, but certainly publicly that's the position. And I should say, I think some of this speech is very much aimed at the Israeli public back home. This is a big news story here. And there's an element of playing to people back home as well in the things that he's saying.
Yeah, and in that, another aspect of his speech, unsurprisingly, very much pointing the finger at Iran, which he's done many times before, is centering on what he's calling the curse of Iran. He's appealing to everyone around him to side with Israel against them. Currently, what is the extent of Iran's involvement? They've sort of been walking this line in terms of backing Hezbollah, but they haven't been directly involved.
Well, there's long been conflict between, like a shadow war, effectively, between Iran and Israel. And Iran does back Hezbollah strongly. It supports it in every kind of way. And so where Israel is in conflict with Hezbollah, it's sort of in conflict with Iran. It's just it's not fully declared. So Iran certainly supports forces that are in conflict with Israel. And Israel has struck in Iran. It struck in Iran early this year when it killed the political leader of Hamas at that stage with an airstrike in Tehran. So Iran and Israel are very much at odds. They are enemies. And I think Mr. Netanyahu today used his speech to set out the position and effectively say Iran is the kind of the power behind all this. They're the great enemy of ours behind all this, and set out his case. And I think he also used the speech to remind the world of what happened on the 7th of October, the horrors that happened to Israeli people, and all of the hostages who were taken, and was also speaking about the hostages who are still held in Gaza, and saying that it's a priority of his government to get them home. There's obviously been a lot of criticism within Israel by many of their families, who say that they feel Mr. Netanyahu's government hasn't done enough to get them home, and many of them, not all of them, but many of them feel that the way to get their loved ones home is some form of ceasefire deal. But as we heard today, that doesn't seem to be a prospect that is currently close to happening.
OK, Daniel DeSimone, thanks for your time on that. Let's speak now to Aaron David Miller, who is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former US State Department official. Good afternoon, Aaron.
Thanks for having me. You
were listening closely to that speech. It was interesting watching those in the room around him and how they reacted. What did you make of it?
Well, there weren't many of them in the room, which is standard operating procedure for Netanyahu's speeches. Look, it was primarily designed for a domestic audience, but I think the unmistakable message, certainly to the UN, and that was as blistering an attack on the United Nations as I think Netanyahu has ever delivered before. I think the messages were clear that with respect to Israel-Gaza, Israel-Hezbollah, and Israel-Iran, the prime minister looks at these as three slow, grinding wars of attrition. He talked very little about diplomacy. He talked about an abstract notion of the concept of peace. He referred, of course, to Israeli-Saudi normalization, which is now just a thought experiment, more tethered to a galaxy far, far away than the realities back here on planet Earth. And I think it really points up the fact that the Biden administration is in what I would call a negotiator's cul-de-sac, both with respect to Gaza and Lebanon. Look, the reality is the Israelis have a legitimate problem in both Hamas and with both Hamas and Hezbollah. And Mr. Netanyahu, frankly, is looking for capitulation on each front rather than a negotiation.
Is he going to get that, though? So this is what the problem is, because, you know, he's talking about this all-out victory as such. Meanwhile, you know, Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, he's talking about being 90% there in terms of a ceasefire. It didn't sound like that today.
Well, I'm not sure. Have you heard that recently from Secretary of State Blinken? I mean, and if you had, it's really very unwise of the administration. Look, there are two... There's one fundamental problem that's standing in the way of a ceasefire, and that is neither Yahya Sinwar, the principal Palestinian decision maker, or Benjamin Netanyahu see any urgency in closing the deal. In fact, Sinwar must realize now that there's a real possibility of escalation on the northern front. He'd rather wait, because at the moment, from the beginning, October 7 was all about embroiling the region in a real regional war. That has not happened. There's obviously confrontation on any number of fronts, but the kind of escalation that is possible, this conflict would morph into something the Middle East has never seen before.
Do you think that's likely?
So no, I see no prospects, and the administration has now tethered the ceasefire in Gaza to ceasefire in Lebanon, and the reality is, in doing that, they're running diametrically opposed to what Netanyahu wants, which is to break the connection. He wants to basically say to Hezbollah, look, you want to have your high trajectory weapons? No problem. You want to control Lebanon as you do? No problem. We have a major problem with you south of the Litani River. If the administration were able to deliver what is called for in UN Security Council Resolution 1701, which followed the last time Israel and Hezbollah got into this, which Hezbollah, frankly, has routinely violated. If the administration could produce that, then I think, unlike the Israeli-Palestinian problem, no Jerusalem, no refugee issues to be negotiated, you could actually imagine a deal. So I think that Netanyahu is in an extremely secure position.
Okay.
There's no opposition at home. He's got 64 seats in a coalition that is unassailable. And the Biden administration, weeks away from one of the most consequential elections in American history, is not going to exert significant or sustained leverage or pressure on Israel.
Aaron, we're going to have to leave it there. We're just out of time on this. That's Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and a former US State Department official. Just to give you an update as well, the Israeli military have just issued a few moments ago saying it is currently striking terror targets belonging to Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. It did not provide any further details. We should also make clear that Israel is not allowing international journalists from media organisations, including the BBC, in independent access to Gaza. At the time is 4:34.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The headlines on Drive Day. Maggie Smith has died at the age of 89. During her 70-year career, she won two Oscars. In recent years, she starred in Downton Abbey, and her co-star, Hugh Bonneville, has praised her sharp wit and formidable talent. We're going to talk about Dame Maggie Smith very shortly. The family of a 19-year-old man who was stabbed to death in Wolverhampton say the sentences given to his two killers are too lenient. The pair, who were 12 when they murdered Sean Cesarhigh, have been sentenced to life with a minimum term of 8.5 years. Lawyers for those who've accused Mohammed Al-Fayed of sexual offences say they're now working with 60 women. Justice for Harrods survivors says it's received an enormous response from victims and witnesses since a BBC documentary last week. And Just Stop Oil supporters have thrown soup over two Vincent van Gogh paintings just hours after two activists were given prison sentences. Phoebe Plummer and Anna Holland were jailed for throwing soup at the painting Sunflowers in 2022. Those are the news headlines. Mike McCarthy's got the sport.
And plans from the All England Club for 39 new tennis courts and an 8,000-seater stadium on Wimbledon Park have been given the go-ahead by London's Deputy Mayor Jules Pipe. The plans, which would allow Wimbledon qualifying to move on-site, were referred after Merton Council approved them, but Wandsworth Council rejected the scheme last November. The ruling decided significant community and economic benefits outweigh the harm to protected open land, but campaigners could still apply for a judicial review. England's cricketers batting first as they fight to keep the one-day international series with Australia alive. Ellie Aldroyd has the latest from Lords.
They made a slow start, but they're cracking on now with Duckett and Brooke in the middle. 150 for two of 135 balls. So we're in the 23rd over of the 39 available, and Ben Duckett has passed 50 for the second time in this series. Brooke batting really nicely alongside him as well. He's on 46. Duckett on 63. England 150 for two in the 23rd over.
Ellie, thank you. You can follow commentary right now on Five Sports Extra. Lots of significant team news in the Premier League today, with Manchester City midfielder Rodri ruled out for the season after knee surgery. Teammate Kevin De Bruyne unavailable to face Newcastle tomorrow as well. The hosts set to be without striker Alexander Isak. Meanwhile, Arsenal goalkeeper David Raya a doubt to face Leicester tomorrow, but Liverpool are expected to have Alisson back between the sticks for the trip to Wolves. Their boss, Gary O'Neill, well, he's got a virus to deal with in his squad ahead of that game. We've got commentary of both of those matches on Five Live Sport. The Women's Champions League group stage draw has seen first-time qualifiers Celtic place with Chelsea and Real Madrid. Arsenal are in the same group as German champions Bayern Munich, while the holders Barcelona await for Vivian Miedema and Manchester City.
It could be worse. Obviously, Barca is a top-class team. It's going to be a really difficult game. But it's really exciting, I think, to measure yourself against the best teams in the world. I think the other two teams, obviously, are going to be tough. Like, you can underestimate anyone. And, yeah, it's going to be exciting to be in Champions League again.
And cycling's governing body, the UCI, says the Road and Paracycling World Championships in Switzerland will continue at the request of the family of Muriel Ferrer. The 18-year-old died in hospital today following a crash in the women's junior road race. Yesterday, she suffered a serious head injury. Peter van der Abele is the sports director of the UCI.
The international cycling community loses a rider with a bright future ahead of her. The UCI and the organizing committee are respecting the wish of the family to continue these world championships.
And that is the latest from BBC Sport.
In the latest travel news, on the roads, County Durham, the A1M northbound one lane is closed between junction 60 at Bradbury and 61 for emergency repairs. Pretty heavy traffic because of that. The M26 eastbound in Kent is partially blocked between junction 2A at Rootham and junction 3. And Hampshire, the M27 eastbound one lane is closed for a broken down vehicle between junction 9 to junction 10. You have got delays because of that. And if you are getting a train this evening, worth double checking. There has been problems today because of flooding on certain parts of the network. Ellie Brennan, Five Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Drive.
Well, as you heard in the news, Dame Maggie Smith has died aged 89. She was one of Britain's best-known actors with a career spanning seven decades. Settle back and enjoy a reminder of some of her work.
Pierre Totem Locomotor. Hogwarts is threatened. Man the boundaries. Protect us. Do your duty to our school.
I've always wanted to use that spell.
People wish to kill you. Anyone who's met you, I imagine. A disguise is necessary to protect us all. And while you are here, you will conduct yourself as a nun. Only I will know who and what you truly are. You will draw no attention to yourself whatsoever.
But look at me. I'm a nun. I'm a penguin.
As from now and until you leave, you are Sister Mary Clarence.
I don't want a special stick. I want an ordinary stick, only longer. Shut the door.
If I should want to get in touch with you, whom should I call?
Well, you can try Mr. Bennett at 23, only don't take any notice of what he says. He's a communist, possibly.
You're a woman with a brain and reasonable ability. Stop whining and find something to do.
Dame Maggie Smith, first of all, was Minerva McGonagall in Harry Potter, Mother Superior in Sister Act, Miss Mary Shepherd in The Lady in the Van, and, of course, the Dowager Countess of Grantham in Downton Abbey. And that, believe you me, is just a small slice of her career. Let's speak to our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson. Hello, Colin.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, a true great. I mean, where do you begin?
I'm glad you got Sister Act in there, because I think... forget about that one. But that's the thing about Dame Maggie Smith. Every generation has their Maggie Smith role. For so many, it will, of course, be Harry Potter and Professor McGonagall, the boss of Gryffindor. And the way that she took that part, and at the start, you kind of were almost a little bit frightened of her and how stern she was. And by the end, in the final battle scenes, you were loving her and rooting for her. The arc that she took it on, apparently that was the only actor that J.K. Rowling requested in the whole series. She said, I want Dame Maggie Smith in Harry Potter. And then if you go all the way back to the end of the 1960s, the role that took her from the stage to the movie screen and won her the Best Actress Oscar, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, a role that really showed what made her special. This 1930s school teacher in Edinburgh, who again managed to do the whole being stern but being funny. And that maybe is the way of summing up Dame Maggie Smith. She managed to do both those things absolutely brilliantly.
Yeah, I've said earlier on, The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, if people get an hour or two to spare this weekend, to try and watch that on catch up telly, because that is fantastic. She wore, I mean, you know, the experience she's had, a lot of people texting the show, Colin, to say she transcended stage and film, that experience, but she wore it lightly, didn't she? She always seemed to have a bit of a wry smile on her face whenever she performed.
Yeah, humour was so crucial to all her work. But she started out, it was Sir Laurence Olivier, who took her to the English National Theatre when it was starting out. She was Desdemona to his Othello on stage. And then they did a film version of that that got her her first Oscar nomination in the mid-60s. So there she was, suddenly making that move from the stage to the big screen. And she managed to combine those two things, doing Shakespeare with doing movies. And you can always judge an actor by who wants to work with them. And Steven Spielberg chose her for his Hook, because she was the Granny Wendy in it. I mean, not her greatest role, but the fact that Steven Spielberg wants to work with you is a sign of just, you know, what a presence she was on the screen.
Well, when Dustin Hoffman decided to direct his first movie, she was in that as well. And while we're at it, you know, you mentioned Sister Act. I think she was in Sister Act 2 as well. So, and all the acclaimed gems. I love her in The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel as well. She's brilliant.
So many, isn't it? Gosford Park, absolutely genius in that. I mean, Downton Abbey, what a huge part of her career. that was as well, playing the matriarch of the family and getting to have those absolute zingers, those one-liners. There was such a highlight in that. I like the fact that when she was on the Graham Norton show, she memorably said that she'd never watched an episode of Downton Abbey, though. It wasn't really her kind of thing. Boy, yeah, too many other things to choose from. I think you're so right, Tony, though. We've got the weekend ahead of us. People should be really looking out something from Dame Maggie Smith to watch this weekend.
Have a Dame Maggie Fest. Yeah, Colin, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson, will speak to a lot of other people as well throughout the programme. Remembering Dame Maggie, if you've got a special memory, if you met her particularly, but if you've got just a memory of something you've enjoyed, let us know, 85058 or WhatsApp us, 08085 909 693.
Yeah, so many of you already getting in touch. Thank you. Loads of you have been getting in touch over the last couple of days as well with the weather conditions where you are. It's been pretty awful. Roads are underwater and rail lines blocked after torrential rain caused flash flooding in central England. Three drivers actually had to be rescued from the M5 near Bristol, while a rail tunnel has been flooded between Bicester and Banbury. Trains are running at reduced speed on the East Coast Main Line due to flooding between Peterborough and King's Cross. Our reporter Simon Jones is near the river in Shefford in Bedfordshire.
Normally you'd be able to walk past along the path, but you can't today because there is so much water and it's flowing very quickly. Now, local residents tell me on Monday the river actually reached the highest level that has ever been recorded here, and a number of homes nearby flooded. So anxiously people are watching what is going to happen as water feeds into this river following the torrential rain we have seen overnight.
Yeah, some incredible images on social media, including at AFC Telford United in Shropshire. Steve Price is the director there. Steve, what's been happening?
We've had a lot of water too here.
Oh, what's that been like? It's not destroyed, is it?
I don't think we've destroyed, but it's caused a lot of damage. I mean, it was heartbreaking last night while it was happening, watching the water come in. Just unbelievable scenes, really. You just can't imagine there's that much water can come from anywhere.
Yeah, it's been all hands on deck too, hasn't it?
Very much so. Very, very lucky from everything happening last night to being literally underwater to what's happened from the media side and volunteers turning up today. We've had about 20 or 30 volunteers turn up today who've started to clean up. It's been a crazy 24 hours.
So what happens next? I mean, do you have any home games coming up that you need to worry about?
We don't. We've got a home game on Saturday, which hopefully will be okay. We have Wolves Women also ground share with us here. We've lost the game on Sunday. We won't be able to get it sorted by them, so we've lost that. We also lost the game last night as it happened. Wolves 21s were playing in the Premier League Europe International Cup, playing against Monaco. So Monaco kind of flown in. Obviously got to the ground about 6 o'clock while it was happening. I don't think they'd ever seen anything like it. So we lost that game here last night. Obviously, Wolves were brilliant about it. We've obviously had all our staff here. We do post-match food for them and everything. So, you know, Wolves, even though they didn't play the game, have picked all the cost up for that, which has been amazing.
That's incredible, because for a club like AFC Telford, a small club, I mean, this could be hugely financially damaging.
Oh, it is going to be financially damaging anyway with the damage that it's caused for us. But again, we've been so lucky. I've had the civil defence unit here. A guy called Tim was on the phone about 7:30 this morning. Brought a fire engine down with his crew, helped clear the water from around the pitch. Oh. Like I said, 20 volunteers turned up.
What do you want to say to those volunteers who turned up to say
it's
thanks?
Just a massive thank you, isn't it? I mean, you know, non-league clubs like ourselves just run on people like that. And, you know, a work day on a Friday, I don't know how many of them missed work, but turned up and have started the cleanup. Obviously, we still haven't got to, you know, assess the damage of financially what it's going to cost us. But, you know, the last 8 hours, they've made such a difference. I mean, I'm down at the ground now, at the stadium now, and, you know, the sunshine, it just looks like a different world to what it looked to last night, where the pitch was under a foot of water. But, yeah, they've just made a massive difference. Well, but still a lot to do. but it's feeling a lot better than it did, like I said, 24 hours ago.
Yeah, a long way to go. Well, good luck with the rest of the cleanup. Steve, thanks for speaking to us. That's Steve Price, the director of AFC Telford United, where the stadium was completely flooded. Unbelievable pictures. It's just approaching 10 to 5.
Yeah, England need to beat Australia to stay in the series. They're playing at Lords. It's underway after a rain-delayed start, and Ellie's there for us. What's happening, Ellie?
It feels like we've had all sorts of weather here today, Tony. You turned up with the umbrellas and the big coats this morning, and now dazzling sunshine at Lords. The sun's just starting to go down behind the pavilion. England 171 for three in the 26th over. We're reduced to 39 overs each because of that rain this morning, but Harry Brooke is going along really well again. The standing England captain is on 59 of 41, and Jamie Smith at the other end is on 8. He just hit a big six off Adam Zampa, but there's been a wicket since you were last with me in the Sports Bulletin, and that was Ben Duckett just sweeping and caught on the backward square leg boundary by Sean Abbott off the bowling of Adam Zampa for 63, put on 79 between him and Harry Brooke. But the momentum has been pretty good for England. Took a while to get started because Stark and Hazelwood bowled so beautifully under the cloud at the start of the innings. But 172 for three, you'd think it's probably okay, but it's just hard to know. We're just not used to 40 overs a side or 39 overs a side. People as old as me who remember the old Sunday League, that was 40 overs a side.
Yeah.
And actually, a score like this already, you'd think, oh, they've got a lot on the board. That's going to be 200 would be impossible to beat. But now things have changed considerably since those days.
They certainly have. We'll reminisce next time we speak, Ellie. Thank you. Ellie Oldroyd there at Lords. Maggie Smith in quartet, says Sue in Somerset, the ultimate comfort blanket film. I've just remembered, I have seen it. It is great. That's another one to add to your
playlist.
So
many good ones,
isn't
there?
Now, he's a wildlife cameraman, a TV presenter, a skilled ornithologist, and to top it all off, a Strictly champion. Also, he caused absolute uproar when he visited the studio. Now, Hamza Yassin Kanad, author to that amazing list. His first book for adults, Be a Birder, was published early this year. And now he's got a book aimed at 8 to 11-year-olds. It's called Hamza's Wild World, I had a chat with him when he popped into the studio yesterday, beginning as hard-hitting as ever, and this is why one day I will get on Newsnight. I asked him why he wrote the book.
The inspiration is the next generation. So David Attenborough and Steve Owen lit that spark in me about the natural world, and I want to be able to do the same for the next generation, because at the end of the day, they're going to be our leaders. They're going to be our prime ministers, our MPs, and they're going to be calling the shots about our wonderful land. Now, if they're doing that, I'd love for them to have a nod towards Mother Nature. I'd love for them to think about the natural world as well as HS2 going through ancient woodlands and all that kind of stuff. So if you can inspire them and get them to learn about the natural world, I guarantee you they will take care of it.
Yeah.
The problem is they don't know. So the more I do my documentaries, the more I do my books and educating the next generation about it, the better it will be.
It's like anything else, isn't it? Kids have a lot going on. You've got to grab their attention about what it is you particularly want to talk about. I love the fact you actually, in your book, celebrate your heroes.
Yeah.
You name check them. You give them enough respect.
Yeah.
I saw a few. I didn't see Johnny Morris in there. Now, Johnny,
No.
Are you familiar with Johnny
very
Morris?
Very much so. Yeah, very much so. Funny you say that, because in the audiobook, I'm making all the little noises and the whistles. So this is the beauty. I'm severely dyslexic. And if you can't physically read and write, it's so much easier to learn from an audiobook. And I am a visual and audio person. That's how I learn. So in the audiobook, I actually imitate and I do a few examples. And, you know, you hear me hooting like an owl and, you know, calling like
a
gorilla.
I'm tempted to ask for it now. I mean, can we have your owl, or would you like to go for something else?
Let's see. It goes.
Now, that is arguably more useful than Johnny Morris. He would just have the owl going, can I have a cup of tea? He'd be doing that and giving it a voice. But, it got me interested. And that's the trigger, isn't it? So, presumably you get amazing feedback from kids, do you?
You know, they're so pure. They are so pure in the sense that they'll ask a question that comes straight in their brain. And as adults, we tell them, no, you can't ask that question. That's too rude or that's too personal. But kids want to know, Ranger Hamster, why is your hair so tall? It's like, and then you see the parents thinking, going, oh, I shouldn't have asked that question. And then they kind of go, I say, it's because I eat all my vegetables when my mum and dad put them on the table. And then you see the dad go, Brussels sprouts.
Yeah.
And Brussels sprouts make it extra long. And that's the beauty of kids. They want to know about wildlife. They want to know about poo. They want to know about everything.
I think there's a chapter on poo. I'm sure I saw
there
it
is.
Earlier on.
There
yeah.
is. Yeah. But that chapter, even though people go, oh, poo, it's not just poo. It's data collecting. Kids will know who's been there, how long it's been, what have they been eating, what yeah. type of animal. So it's all clues about the natural world. And if you get them started using mobile phones, I know we people say technology and we want to get the kids off screens. Very true. Very, very true. I want more kids with dirt underneath their fingernails, like I used to. But if they do love their screens, let's use it to their advantage. Yeah. Let's go outside. Let's use the macro function on the cameras on our mobile phones and let's photograph the ladybirds. How many spots is it? How many legs does something have? Can you see the teeth on the snail? What do you mean, teeth on the snail? It's like, oh, they've got thousands of teeth. I was like, I want to see that.
Yeah.
You know, that's the beauty about it.
What I like about the book as well is, just talking to you now, your brain's, you know, alive. It's here, there and everywhere. And the, yeah. the book's an adventure. It's not... You know, it's kid-friendly. There are
yes.
not... It's not dense words.
No.
There are loads of brilliant... We should name-check Louise Forshaw, who's done
yes.
all the illustrations.
Yeah, absolutely. And the beauty about that is we made sure that the book doesn't have to be chapter one, chapter two, chapter three. And if you miss out a chapter, you don't understand what's going on.
Yeah.
You can turn a page, any page you want, and you can pick up some information. And there's all sorts of things like the did you know? They were like, did you know that an animal does this? And did you know that a baby blue whale drinks a bath full of milk every day? And that's the sort of stuff that kids absolutely absorb. But because I'm severely dyslexic, I worked with Dyslexia Scotland on this, and I wanted it to be legible for kids, and especially kids who are dyslexic. So instead of monologues and monologues of just blocks of text,
yeah.
I filled it with diagrams, I filled it with my own images, I filled it with explanations and little charts of these animals, and I rank them. I was even a judge in this book. I judged some birds' displays and I gave them a mark out of 10, similar to Strictly. But you have a bit of fun with it. So if someone loves Strictly, they can kind of go, oh, I never knew. Hamza gave this bird a 10. I want to yeah. go and see it for myself.
Yeah.
Or Hamza did this. So this is what I want in it. And it's got all the little anecdotes that I've built up over my time as a wildlife cameraman traveling the world, all into one book, distilled in there. So it's a fun way of learning about the natural world, and hopefully kids really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's designed. You can just pick it up and put it down again and read a few pages and go back, and you, like you say, go back 50 pages and read something else. What about children then? And you know, if this book is a catalyst, not everyone, we talked about this just before we turned the microphones on, not everybody can live on a country estate and have deer looking over the fence, can they? So
100%.
What about kids in urban environments? What do you say to them?
It's really funny you ask that question, because I guarantee you if I go outside now and spend about 20 minutes, I'll find you the world's fastest animal. The peregrine falcon. They live in our cities. If you know where to look, and it's all about knowing, if you know where to look and how to find them, there is so much wildlife around us. Now, I live in the countryside. I live in the Hebrides. Seeing a fox is like a rarity to me. Mm. Now, I speak to someone in London, they go, oh, they come to my backyard every day.
Yeah.
So it's knowing what to look for and where to find it and how to approach it. Approach it with respect and kindness, and I guarantee you they'll open up. So in cities, there's ringneck parakeets, swans, geese, great crested grebes. There's so much happening in cities, and the beauty about stuff in cities, wildlife in cities, is they're used to people. So I find it difficult getting close to stuff in the West Coast because it never sees humans and it runs away.
Yeah.
But if you go to Richmond Park, I guarantee you you'll get pretty close to a heron. So it's just knowing what to look for and appreciating it.
Exploring a little bit, opening your mind. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but just outside that window there is the Blue Peter Garden. I'm half thinking we should go and dig it up. Imagine what we'd find. We'd be in the papers, but imagine what we'd find.
But that's the whole point. So if you make it a game, that's where the kids love. Kids love games. And sometimes you have to let them win. Sometimes you have to teach them how to find things and lose a little bit. But make it into a game. Make it into a tick box. And rewarding, that's what kids love. So I always take my nieces and nephews, like, right, we need to find 5 different birds and see how many invertebrates are there. Uncle Hamza, what's an invertebrate? There we go. Now, that's a very good question. Let's talk about it.
Yeah.
What's an exoskeleton? What's not? So we talk about it, and slowly, slowly, they're absorbing. And kids are like sponges. They just absorb everything you give them.
And we're running out of time. So final question is,
yeah.
have you seen enough? When you produce books like this and you do your TV stuff,
yeah.
have you seen enough in the very younger generation to think the planet's going to be safe in their hands?
100%. 100%. I have hope for the future. And hope is the only thing that will keep me driving forward. But seeing the young generation smiling and talking and knowing what the different names of dinosaurs are and stuff fills me with joy. They are the next generation. They are the future. And may they look after this planet better than we did as the adults and the grandparents.
Hamza, good luck with the book.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, Tony.
Thank you. He's a really top chap. He and his publicist after the interview said, that was the best one. You didn't ask anything about Strictly. And I thought, oh, I was supposed to. I completely forgot.
Much rather have oil impressions.
So, well, you say out. So, hello, this text here, no name. And it says, my cats are now looking around the kitchen for an hour. They're very confused. This was Hamza. That's good, isn't it? So when I was a kid in the 60s and 70s... What's happening?
Is he back?
Yeah. Everyone seemed to be able to impersonate animals. It was kind of, if you sat round at a family party, people would do that.
There was nothing.
apart from whittle.
Who needs TikTok, eh?
So I wonder, just we have these voice notes on WhatsApp. Is the art of animal impersonation dead in today's younger generation? Would you send us, and we can play Guess the Listener Animal, send us an impersonation.
I did not know it was alive. Sorry.
What?
The art of animal impression.
No.
This was the thing.
Has it ever been alive? Yeah, everyone had a party piece back in the day.
What was yours then? What was your animal?
I was only a kid. I could only look on and wonder when they did them.
Oh.
But... Well,
this is your opportunity. Tony, right here today.
No, I'm judging it. Can you impersonate an animal? And if so, send it to us and we'll play it. Doesn't get any better than this. 08085 is the number. 08085 909 693. Can you join our menagerie?
The Voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Drive.
Okay, Holly and Tony here with you until 7 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, let's get your BBC News headlines. One of the UK's greatest and most celebrated actors, Dame Maggie Smith, has died at the age of 89. Now, she recently starred as the Countess of Grantham in Downton Abbey. Her co-star, Hugh Bonneville, has praised her sharp eye, sharp wit and formidable talent. During her 70-year career, she won 2 Oscars and became known to a new generation for her role as Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films.
Now, today we will be transforming animals into water goblets, like so. 1, 2, 3. Ferroverto.
So many to choose from. And Dame Maggie told the Graham Norton show she may have played the role a little too convincingly.
One kid once said to me, he said, Were you really a cat? And I heard myself say, just pull yourself together.
And the Prime Minister has called Dame Maggie Smith a true national treasure. And BAFTA has described her as a legend of British stage and screen. In other news, 2 boys have been given life sentences with a minimum of 8.5 years for murdering a teenager with a machete. The pair were just 12 years old when they attacked Sean Sisahe in a park in Wolverhampton in November last year. They're the UK's youngest convicted murderer since the James Bulger case in 1993. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told the United Nations General Assembly that his country is fighting for its life against what he called savage enemies. Mr. Netanyahu said the offensive against Hezbollah in Lebanon would continue. Our correspondent Daniel De Simone is in Jerusalem.
He made absolutely no reference to the possibility of a ceasefire. He said his government will keep on fighting Hezbollah until victory. And I think it's important to add that, you know, a lot of people see the way to a ceasefire with Hezbollah as the only